On a blustery Wednesday afternoon, Dean Strang and I met at his office in Madison, Wisconsin, for our first discussion about representing Stephen Avery, the most famous innocent man in the state's history. It was about 3 p.m., March 1st, 2006. At the very moment Dean and I started speaking, a new drama was coming to an end, 135 miles away, that we knew nothing about, but that would change everything. A 16-year-old boy was sitting on a couch in a room of the Manitowoc County Sheriff's Office. His moon face was hidden in his palms, which were pressed into his head. Seated next to him, the boy's mother tried to wrench off the mask formed by his hands, but his fingers would not yield. Leaning forward, elbows on his legs, head in hands, he was bent into the position people are instructed to take during a plane crash. He had spent nearly the whole day with interrogators, offering grunts and yas to one leading question after another. One of his longest utterances was to ask if he could get back for a class at 1:29 p.m., explaining, "I have a project due in 6th hour. A man spoke to the boy's mother, assured in his tone, "We've been doing this job a long time, Barb, and we can tell when people are telling the truth." The boy's name was Brendan Dassey, and although his name was unfamiliar to Dean and me then, we would soon be finding out a lot more about him and what had happened that day. While Brendan was seated, miserably, in Manitowoc, Dean and I spoke about my joining the defense of Stephen Avery, who was accused of killing a woman at his family's auto salvage and burning her body. Dean had already been retained. For close to an hour, we had gone over practical matters like the division of labor, what had been learned by the public defenders who had been his lawyers when he was first arrested, the resources available from Avery to hire experts and investigators, and where the case stood. Up to that point, the charges seemed based on strictly circumstantial evidence. Then the phone rang. An Avery relative was calling. Dean's end of the conversation at the beginning was mostly uh-huhs and yeses, so I half-listened and glanced around the office. On the walls, he had a few pieces of artwork depicting events in legal history, a scholarly interest of Dean's. He also had a standing desk, which not too many people were using at that time. It caught my eye because I'd had back problems a few years earlier. A trophy stood on a shelf, which I would later learn was for hurling. Hurling is an ancient Irish game, a tougher, more physical ancestor of field hockey. Dean didn't play, but a friend had given him the trophy as a present. He and I were partners in different firms. We had worked together a few times, and I had high regard for his work and acumen. Dean wasn't part of the crowd that hung out in courthouse watering holes, but he was level-headed and a relentless, hard-driving professional, quick on his feet. Also, he was hard not to like, which was important because we were going to spend a lot of time together. Now I could hear his side of the phone call take a turn. "You've got to be kidding me," he was saying. "Arrested? The nephew? For what?" At age 43, Stephen Avery had already fallen once into the gulf between what is preached and what is practiced in America's criminal justice system. It took him more than 2 decades to climb out and less than 2 years to fall back in. Stephen Avery had spent 18 years in prison for a sexual assault he had nothing to do with before the real culprit was identified through DNA testing and Stephen was unequivocally cleared. Now, Avery was facing an even more serious charge, the murder of a young woman, Teresa Halbach, who had come to his family's auto salvage yard to take advertising photos for a trade magazine. In the story initially laid out by the authorities, before there was a trial, before anyone outside law enforcement had looked at any of the evidence, Avery's guilt was a foregone conclusion. Some of the victim's burned remains were found near a garage used by Avery. His blood was in her car. Her car key had been discovered in his bedroom. But this tidy narrative of detective work grew messier as details emerged about the peculiar circumstances under which the supposedly incriminating evidence against Avery had been gathered. Some of the investigators were not even supposed to have been on the Avery property, or indeed have anything at all to do with the case, because they were connected in various ways to the frame-up that had sent Avery to prison 2 decades earlier. Once their involvement was revealed, public certainty about Avery's guilt began to erode. Even before this meeting with Dean, I'd been following the story on television and in the newspaper, like many other people in the Wisconsin area. My connection to it was deeper than most. I had met Stephen Avery. As it happened, I'd served on the legislative task force that was set up to investigate what went wrong in his wrongful rape conviction and to recommend reforms.